all of that time when I was at Grendon's was a huge time when I made meaning of the universe, and what people did was really sort of taken apart and put back together again, and taken apart and put back together again. And I was being taken apart and put back together again.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, a podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Today we're having a conversation with Roland Woodward, and Roland is a chartered forensic psychologist and has more than 40 years' experience of working in the criminal justice system, most of it within the prison service. Roland worked at HMP Grendon and has also managed the psychological services at Gartree Prison, where he opened the first therapeutic community for life sentence prisoners. Following that, he was the first director of therapy at the Dovegate Prison Therapeutic Community, which has 200 residents in 5 different communities.
Nice to meet you, Roland.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Yes, and I think your name's very well known throughout the prison system, because you've been very influential in many, many prisons. I wondered if you could tell us a bit about how you got started on a career in forensic psychology.
I've just been reading a book, and it's a book by Gary Wilson about why working class white guys, boys, don't succeed in education. I was born in the 40s, so I was at school in the 50s and 60s. And in those days, if you were dyslexic, not that they ever recognised it, but if you were dyslexic, you ended up being the bloke at the back who played with the raffia while everybody else got on with the interesting stuff. So there's a natural progression from being told you're crap and doing raffia at the back of the class to more interesting things like nicking stuff and smoking and drinking and sort of generally acting out your frustrations and adolescence. So the consequence was my adolescent years and things were quite interesting. And I had lots of mates who went off and did ball stall and things and whatever else. But the time I left school, I was one of those working class kids who I'd managed to cling on in the comprehensive system because they were desperate for numbers. So if you didn't actually beat a teacher up and you said, I'll come back after I'm 16, they go, yeah, where have you, regardless. So I managed to cling on, and I managed to leave school at 18 from this wonderful comprehensive experiment with one O level. And I kicked around for years doing jobs and stuff and warehousing and all the rest of it. But all the time I knew that I was basically frustrated and whatever. So in the end, I decided I was going to go to university. And what I wanted, people had always interested me, because, you know, people I come across and things. So it always interested me. And I was always fairly kind of political. I don't like this system. And I saw lots of my mates get sort of sent down or have a rough time and things, or, you know, just didn't make it. So I decided I wanted to be involved in some way with the criminal justice system. So, and I was in people. So psychology was my kind of way in, really. I managed to kind of cobble together enough qualifications at A-levels, and I blagged my way into university, really. They very foolishly offered me an unconditional place. And that was kind of like, woohoo, as long as I turn up, I'll be all right. It's a bit more complicated than that. But I got enough to get in. And because once I was in, I was 23 when I went to uni. I was probably the most boring person there, because I was all over it. I couldn't get enough of it, you know. And I'd go in. And the dyslexia was a nightmare. So I would write these notes, and then I would go home at night and type them out all over again. So it was, but I, yeah. So I ended up, and we were getting towards the end, and I specialised in psychophysiology, and I did neuro and muscle for my specialities, and I was becoming a real kind of, this is a science, and I'm into it, whatever else. And then somebody asked me in the third year, what are you going to do when you leave? And I thought, shit, I need a job. Because at the time, going on and where I was in life, it just wasn't possible to go on and do a master's or anything like that. I needed a job. So I applied to prison service. And in those days, you applied, and if you got a job, they posted you anywhere in the country where they had jobs. And I went along, and I was informally interviewed by Gloria Laycock at Wormwood Scrubs, which was my local prison. And then I went to a board interview, and then I heard nothing for weeks. And in the end, I rang them up and I said, you know, I came along for an interview sometime. Is there any chance of you telling me how I got on? And they went, oh, yeah, sorry, you got a job. And I said, oh, it's brilliant. So where am I going? Because I was living in London at the time. I was in Shepherd's Bush. And they said, you're going to Leicester. And it was kind of like, where's that? You know, it was kind of like, I spoke to people and sort of said, do you know where Leicester is? They go, it's a roundabout on the M1 somewhere, isn't it? And so I ended up at Glen Parva. They just built this brand new young offender Borstal complex in Leicester. It was the biggest in Europe at the time. And they said, we're sending you there because we've built a psychophysiology lab in there, and we want you basically to go and wire up loads of young adolescents. And so that's one of the things that I did. But while I was there, I bumped into my first therapeutic community. Dr. Rosemary Wall was the medical officer there, but she had a rather interesting sort of assistant psychiatrist who at the time, her name was Judy McKenzie, and she's now Judy Isaacs. And Judy is got a long, long history in TCs, but she was the psychiatrist who was looking after this adolescent TC. And I kind of got interested in it. I was never a participant, but I got to talk to the staff about how they were working. I got talked to Judy occasionally about how they used to work and things. And I got really interested in that. And when it came to it, there came a point when you could get promotion. But in those days, if you got promotion, they moved you. And it was like, you know, prison officers who became senior officers just got posted out to a new prison. So I got posted to Grendon. And I got into Grendon and thought, this is interesting. And then after that, it was kind of like I got my master's paid for. And I went off and I did my master's in psychological therapies and counselling and therapy. And I met people there who I was doing, I'm a logical positive person done with psychophysiology stuff and whatever else. And I was bumping into people who were talking about different ways of thinking about people and the way in which groups worked and what was going on. And of course, in my day job, I was watching all this happen, and I was in amongst a group of psychiatrists and psychologists who absorbed all of that and were working away at that. In that process, the other thing that I did was, for the 2 years that I was doing it, I was participant in a psychodrama group. I joined a group that was run by Ginny Jeffries, so I actually went in as, you know, I need fixing as much as anybody else, and so was part of it. So not only did I, during my MSc, have to do my own therapy and my own experiential group stuff, I also did the psychodrama stuff, which was, again, a real eye-opener. Watching Ginny Jeffries work in such an explosive, powerful and sensitive way, actually getting people to move and be people and sort of act it out and be there, was right in my ballpark, because I mean, it's the dyslexic bit of me that likes the movement and the shapes and the colours and everything else and doing things and whatever. So I was really, really fortunate. So that's what set me alight. And it was the first time I'd come across Yalom, Irving Yalom. And here was a guy who fitted the scientist bill, because he kind of took things apart, and there was a real scientific basis to it. But what he came out with was really practical stuff that you could work in a group and whatever. So that time when I was at Grendon's was a huge time when I was sort of really sort of had the way I made meaning of the universe and what people did was really sort of taken apart and put back together again, and taken apart and put back together again. And it was kind of, and I was being taken apart and put back together again. So huge amounts of that came sort of good, really. And I think it gave me a sense of being able to play. So, I mean, one of the things I did at Grendon was I brought Motion House in to do a dance workshop, a week-long sort of thing with them and whatever else. And that landed us in a bit of hot water with the press and things. But, you know, you could do those kinds of things in a TC, really. One of the things I think that I realised fairly early on, which I found really exciting and other people found really scary, was when I discovered that lots of what I do is driven by my unconscious and I haven't got a clue why I'm doing it at the time or whatever else, that really excited me. Now, there are some people who get really freaky about that and go, oh, don't tell me I'm out of control. But it's kind of like, I actually like that. But it also made me realize that if that was the case, then my internal universe could never settle, because the world changes around me, the relationships that I have with people change, and there's reasons for all of that and whatever else. So it's a flux. And as as I've got older and things have happened to me and things or whatever else, I suppose the reason I'm still doing the work and still involved with things like enabling violence or whatever else is, I'm just bloody nosy, because I want to know how my internal universe is changing and what's going on and whatever else. And it's trying to sort of stay in the game. I mean, my mother was an international socialist and a real kind of liberal and inclusive and whatever else. And as she got older, she lived in a community that she became estranged from, because where she lived just changed in character, because people from different cultures and races moved in and sort of her whole kind of social landscape changed around her. And she ended up actually being quite racist. And it wasn't that, you know, that was a million miles from where she started out with. But what somehow she got stuck and stopped trying to make sense of the real world that she lived in and what was going on around her. And it, you know, and it stopped. And I'd like to think that somehow I avoid that I stay in that kind of, you know, questioning what's going on and things. And I find myself going out and seeking people and going, what do you think about that? how does that work and things?
So, yeah, I think that's really fascinating that, you know, in terms of your comfort with the discomfort of not knowing and being open to changing your mind and obviously embracing that. But I wondered what other kind of like major learning points you had from that period at Grendon.
I think one of the things was the difference between what people's perception of the client group were and the reality of actually having a relationship with them and working with them and things. And that when you began to go on their journey with them, it became obvious that there were real reasons why they were the way they were and what they did and everything else. And I think it taught me to listen. I mean, it doesn't sound like I listen now. I've sort of run off at the mouth, really. But my actual style of working was to listen and listen and listen and remember what people had said in order to be able to pick up those things that didn't match and be able to ask those questions like, how do you hold these two things in your head? You know, you said on this day that you did this and now you're saying this is where you are. How does that work for you? And really trying to sort of tease it out with them and understand that. So yeah, I think that, and also the bit about being nosy and curious and not to be scared to ask, and that can be pretty tricky in a forensic, you know. You get somebody who's real, you can see that it's bubbling away inside them and they're really, really angry. And it's having the nerve, I think, really, to in some senses ignore that and ask questions like, well, what would you be if you weren't a victim? And it's kind of trying to get to those core bits, really, and ask those questions. So, I mean, Grendon sort of taught me that, really, to bide my time. But it also taught me that there is a real nonsense in therapy, in psychology, in psychiatry, this forever seeking the secret ingredients in therapy. The question always was, well, what are the bits in therapeutic communities that work? Because if we can work that down, can we cram it all into 6 months? And what I learned was that people change, but they change at a rate. And it's kind of like all the research on terms of reconviction showed that those guys that did 18 months and had time to consolidate and really work through it were the ones that didn't reconvict. And it was the ones that dipped out earlier. They got a bit of things, but they were the ones that were likely to recommit. And it was a kind of like having not only listening, but having the patience to wait and work with the person at their pace, knowing that people needed 18 months because they needed that time to work through and consolidate and really sort of learn new skills and things. And I kind of lost patience with people who sort of said, well, we've now got these sort of short-term interventions which are just as good as whatever else. And it was kind of like, it just felt to me like you've got rid of the symptoms, but you've done nothing real with that person's universe inside. You haven't actually shifted their understanding at all. So I think that was crucial. And I felt kind of vindicated when I went to Gartry and we finally got the lifers thing set up. And that was a real joy. I found some beautiful prison staff to train and to work with there. It's sort of fabulous group of guys and women. And I remember we trained the guys, we trained the staff team, and they spent the morning training. In the afternoon, they did the operational stuff and they painted things and whatever else. Then we got the cons in and started working with them. And there were two crucial points. There was a point after about the first 6 weeks where something really popped in a community meeting, and we kind of contained it and dealt with it and sort of whatever else, I worked with it. And we got into the office afterwards to do the post community meeting debrief. And one of these guys sat down and said, "Oh shit, did we do that?" It was kind of like, "Yeah, you did. But it only happened because you've made it safe enough for that to happen." And they looked at each other and went, "Are we going to be doing more of this?" And I sort of said, "Yeah, you are. You know, this is, but what we do with this stuff now is important." So, and then they kind of got it. And then a few months down the line, we come back in after small group supervision, and Slope, one of the staff, sat down and he looked terrible. And we all kind of sort of had our coffee and things. And we just said, "You know, what's going on for you?" And he said, "That's the worst group I've had so far. It's terrible." And we said, "Well, you know, what happened?" And he said, "This guy has just talked my life." And we said, "Well, tell us about that." And he said, "Well, this guy has just described how he's been looking after his father, who's dying of cancer and all the rest of it." And he said, "And that's exactly what I'm doing." And he said, "I just didn't know what to do with it." And it was the first time that anybody in the team had suddenly discovered that no matter how much they were trained or they could sit there or whatever else, sooner or later, somebody opens your doors. And all the stuff that you think you've got locked away just goes whoosh. And suddenly they realize that they're in a process that can do it to them, even if they don't want it done to them. And yeah, that everybody suddenly then got that and sort of said, oh, that's why you insist on supervision and doing all the stuff you do. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it takes courage, doesn't it, to be a staff member, especially like psychologists kind of know what they're signing up for, psychotherapists know what we're signing up for, but prison officers, that's not part of their job description when they join.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. And I mean, it's kind of, the next big thing in that was the first time one of the rest, because it was all lifers, after about 6 months, this guy suddenly broke down in a small group and talked about how he'd murdered his best friend and he'd felt so much shame and guilt, he'd never allowed himself to grieve. And he just imploded, really. All that guilt and grief that he felt for what he'd done just poured out of him. And of course, we went into feedback and that all came out in feedback. And the staff went and went, "Whoa, that was pretty heavy." And somebody sort of said, "Yeah, it reminds me a bit of my, you know, I've had a recent loss as well." But what happened was it was like a domino effect. Every one of them suddenly went through all their grieving and loss and stuff, what they do, and so did the staff team. And it was like we were doing the groups and coming out into our things and going, "Oh Christ, somebody else has gone," and somebody else is saying, "But that was just like mine." And we spent 6 months, the second 6 months at Gartree, the community worked through all the group, and so did the staff team. And that group of life, I mean, that what we got out of that was that we couldn't expect lifers to go through in a normal 18 months. We knew that there was at least another 6 months extension on the time that they needed because of what they'd experienced and what had happened to them. But that first year was rugged.
Highlighting something really important, I think, though, as well about, you know, I think quite often there's an approach to people in prison as they're kind of like othered and seen as being different. And what you're really highlighting is the shared humanity of staff and prisoners, that fundamentally everyone is a human being and there are common experiences, whether or not people have offended or not. And how important it is to be able to see that we are all alike, as well as here working on something that's quite difficult.
Yeah, no, I think you forget the human because of the keys and the hidden sort of aspect of the of a prison and things. You forget that you know the people in there are very real, very people and sort of lived at extremes sometimes. But it's the little things that get to them and got to us as staff. In that we were sitting there one day. And we'd finished groups and it was a community. We finished a community and we'd come out into our office and we had this peculiar office that where you could see both floors because it had a huge glass front, but we could see both doors. And there was a door out into a courtyard, an exercise yard, which we always left open. So at the end of a community meeting or small groups, if some people felt they needed to get out and walk around, they could. And this particular day, we were sort of just talking about what had gone in the community and it was throwing it down. There was a thunderstorm going on outside and it was throwing down. And this guy walked out and we watched him just standing in the courtyard. And then a couple more went with him and we kind of thought, we can't keep our conversation up here. So we went downstairs, we said, "John," for want of a better word, it wasn't his name, but "John, what are you doing?" And he said, "I've been in prison 11 years, he said, "and this is the first time I've actually been able to stand in the rain, because when it rains like this or whatever else, then exercise gets cancelled." And he said, "This is the first time." And they were all out there. And it was kind of like, so this is what rain is like. So it was the first time in 11 years. And we all just sort of stood there with our mouths open going, we'd never thought of that. Never once had it occurred to any member of staff that could be an experience of, you know, that they'd missed out on. And it was kind of like, yeah, okay, Yeah, we get that now.
Fascinating. I mean, what you're describing is so full of life, Roland. It's just amazing stuff. Can I just ask you something, though? Because I was struck by your description of you going to Glenparva, your meeting with Judy McKenzie there, and then getting posted to Grendon. It sounded as if those were very kind of powerful times in your life.
Yeah, go on.
Well, sounds as if you're going to disagree with that. So.
They were powerful times, but I mean there was a lot going on for me at the same time. So I mean, personally, there was a lot of things that were changing and going on, and my son had been born and things, and there was all sorts of stuff going on, sort of for me personally. So I mean, I was just fascinated really by everything that I was bumping into. I mean, when I went to Glenparva, I was expecting loads of guys in uniform and sort of, you know, big tough screws and all the rest of it and things. And I got there, and when I got there, it was just an assessment unit and a couple of ball students. The rest of the place wasn't open. None of the staff wore uniform. The guys, the Bolster boys, wore uniform, as they were called, things like that, but the staff didn't. And, you know, they sort of got on with it. And I thought that was really peculiar. I was expecting all sorts of stuff. And they sort of used first names and they talked and things. And I met a prison officer, a principal prison officer, a guy called Bernie Ashman, who kind of had been around the block, but he stood no nonsense. But he held on a Friday night. These units were 40 strong. Okay, on a Friday night, Bernie would hold a unit meeting with 40 Borstal boys and his staff in his big association area, and he'd sit there and he'd go, right then, any complaints, anything you want to raise or talk about, because, you know. And I was there one night, and he was doing his bit, and they were sort of, they moaned about the food and things and all they do. And this guy sort of said, I want to know why I was nicked. and Bernie said, well, how did you get nicked? He said, well, I told an officer to fuck off. And I got nicked. And he said, well, you know, what's your complaint? And he said, well, the officer had told me to fuck off before that. And he said, well, who was it? And he said, well, it was Mr. Johnson there. And the guy was sitting there, and Bernie just turned around to him and said, would you like to explain that, Mr. Johnson? And it was real kind of, you know, and talking to him after, and this guy, Johnson, sort of said after, he said, I'll never do that again. And Bernie was absolutely clear, you know, if you're going to nick people, you nick them for something reasonable, but you don't actually give them a model like that to. And that was, I suppose, really the first ever kind of community meeting that I see. But this guy was just doing it off his own bat in terms of, you know, this is what you do in order to sort of make life tolerable for people. So, yeah, I was quite taken about that.
So you obviously learnt a lot, both at Glenparva and at Grendon. And the question that was in my mind was whether you thought that all that learning and those experiences changed you as a person.
Yeah, I think they made me listen. And it made me realise I didn't have all the answers. And I think I was unsure about what I was going into. And I felt I needed to kind of have some expertise that could validate my existence in being there, really. I did. So, I mean, I did quite a lot of things like setting up psychoeducation stuff and things with the guys and sort of doing some research on that. And I had the psychophysiology stuff going on as well about sort of early identification of psychopaths and things. So it was kind of like there was that bit of me, but in the midst of being terribly professional and carrying out my trade, there was all this other interesting stuff that was going on. And I mean, you know, I mean, it's these Borstal officers. I went in one weekend to finish an assessment with the guy that I'd been working with. And I said to him, before the end of the week, I will finish it, even if I have to come back in the weekend. And he said, yeah, okay. So I went back in on the Saturday morning to see what was there. And I went into his unit and I said to the SO at the desk, he's so-and-so. He said, oh, no. PO's taking him home. And I said, what? And he said, yeah. He always takes him home, sort of a couple of weekends. Takes him home and he does the old lady's garden next door to where the PO lives. And the PO gives him lunch and things and whatever else, then brings him back in the evening. And it's kind of like, this PO was one of these slash peak guys who kind of, you know, was absolutely rigid during the day and sort of whatever else. And there he was at the weekend treating his kid like he was his own, really. And that made me think, yeah, okay, underneath all of this stuff, all this hard man stuff and whatever else, there is a layer of humanity that's going on here, which is very, very different. And it's kind of, you know, I mean, this was in the days when anybody in uniform in a prison or whatever else, you're either a factory boy or an army boy. And it was run on that kind of real macho kind of, you know, it's blokes and this is how we deal with it and whatever else. So when they were in the uniform, they were doing all that crap and whatever else. And then they were taking them home at the weekend and things and stuff. And it was just, yeah. And it wasn't far beneath the surface as well. Me and a couple of the guys ended up taking some of them training and running and things, and they ran the marathon with us and stuff and things as well. So there was all sorts of stuff that went on in that allowed some flexibility. And then somebody decided that because you couldn't trust prison officers not to abuse their power, they took away from them the personal officer's ability to recommend 2 weeks back off Borstal time or whatever else and give instant reward and whatever else. And it's almost like it cut the ground out from underneath the staff straight away because they had no leeway. It was all became a bureaucratic process, really. So, yeah. But I think that's, I learned over time that organisations are crap actually, especially forensic organisations, are crap at trusting their staff in relationships and working or whatever else. You know, relationships are seen as security risks, you know, and that's just, yeah. I mean, it happened, but the number of times it happened over the years was relatively small, really.
But I think you also learned a good deal about what we now call relational work, and you could see it occurring in the staff around you, even sometimes. Yeah. The most inauspicious circumstances.
Yeah, I mean that's true. I mean, I had a really mixed up kid who lived locally, and one of the officers explained his explanation of this guy was, he said, in there's a really nice kid, but it's like somebody's taken all the bits out and put them all back in the wrong place. And this kid was well, I mean, he was a real challenge as far as I was concerned in terms of working with him and trying to sort of get in there and find out what was going on for him. But in terms of what he did was just amazing, really, in terms of how he had no concept of the rules at all. And there was two occasions. There was one occasion when two of the staff felt sorry for him, because he never got a day out, he never got visits and things or whatever. So they decided that they would take him to the zoo for a day. And they took him to the local zoo. And I saw them when they came back and they looked absolutely knackered and all over the place. And this kid had run off back into his room and things. And we said to him, how did it go? And he said, it was great, he said. He ran around the place, he screamed, he laughed, he pointed at the animals, he sort of ate and sort of things and whatever else, he said, until we got to the chimpanzees, and he said, and he discovered that chimpanzees would throw their crap at people out. And he said, even the little bugger was running up, picking it up and throwing it back at him, and he got into a crap fight with his chimpanzees and had to sort of heave him away and bring him back. And his party piece was on Friday nights, he'd get it. It would be everybody be sitting around being bored or sort of pissed off because it's Friday night and they couldn't go out and sort of all the rest of it. And there'd be about, 30 of the 40 sitting around their tables playing games or whatever else. He would appear and he'd strip off his clothes, get stark naked, and he would pour oil over himself and say, "Come and catch me." And you'd see the staff trying to corral this kid and catch him and things and whatever else. And people would just be in laughter all over the place. And it sounds horrendous when you talk about it now that that could go on. But within that context and in that time, it was kind of like it was just a piece of Borstal life that everybody kind of went, "Oh no, he's doing his Friday night thing again." And nobody did anything different. Nobody ever left him alone or whatever else. It was almost like the staff joined in and sort of colluded with the kind of "we'll chase you" and it'll be fun and things of whatever else. But yeah. So it was a kind of different world, but in a sense it was more human than it feels as times now.
Thanks. So you'd had all that kind of creative learning taking place in your life, and then you got approached to go and lead the new developing TC at, well, it was first called Morton Lane and then Marchington and ended up being called Dovegate.
Yeah. By that time, I'd gone to Gartree and I had a department of my own, and I went there when it was a dispersal prison and it was an H block, about 240 people, but it was high secure. They had a Rule 47 unit, which was tucked away and things. That's when it came out of the dispersal unit, Bob Perry became the governor and he asked for ideas of what to do with the Rule 47 wing. And that's how the TC got seen. So we'd been running that for a few years and I'd become a principal psychologist by then, and it was in the time when the prison service was changing and they're having unified grades. So I went from being a principal psychologist to being a grade 7, which meant I could get shuffled off into all sorts of different things centrally. They were ripping out psychology as a unit at the center and putting stuff into areas and things, and I was kind of itchy by then. And somebody sidled up to me. It was Eric Cullen, actually, who was still at Grendon. Who was he still at Grendon? He was still around. He was kicking around. But he'd fallen in with a guy from Premier Prisons. They were going to bid for the contract to build a new, brand new prison therapeutic community at Marchington. And I was asked if I would be on the project team, on the bid team for Premier. And I said, yeah, because, it was interesting people. And I thought that's a really good idea in terms of the geography and the architecture. And so I went along. And I got more and more involved with the project team and the bid. So I ended up starting to write parts of the bid and the theory manuals and everything. Because in order to do the bid, you had to write the theory manual, the training manual. So I wrote the training stuff for it and everything else. And I was really into it. By the end of this, I was getting quite excited. I have to say, by this time, I was looking to get out. Whereas before I'd been wearing long hair, bright colours and everything else, I actually changed the way I look and I started wearing nothing but suits and black and white and short hair and things, because I knew out there in the real world, they wanted presentable professional thing that could front things. So by that time I was presenting as a kind of, Moss Bros kind of dummy, really. But it was deliberate because I knew that the way I was, I wouldn't get taken seriously or sort of taken on. So I entered into this project and worked away at it. And we got to the point where, I can't explain to you the pressure of putting a bid together where it's millions. And you know, it's a really big project. And by this time, I was really fired up because I'd seen what the possibilities were in this. And so we kind of got to the stage where the bids went in, or we were preparing to put the bid in, all the last bits and pieces going. And then suddenly, Mike Gander, who was he'd been the youngest governing governor, and he'd been at Norwich. And he was the first governing governor who skipped to the private sector. And he lost all his friends and he was treated like a pariah for doing that. But he was a really bright guy and really creative. And he was coordinating the bid process. And he asked me, he sort of said, would you be willing to be the director of therapy there? And I said, maybe. So, I more or less sort of said, what's in it for me? And he said, well, you get to shape it, you get to run it, you get to sell it, and this is what we'll pay you, and you get a car and all sorts of things. And I sort of said, yeah, I'm up for that. I thought about it long, about whether or not I really wanted to work in the private sector and the risk of jumping from a safe kind of, you know, civil service pension and things. And I thought, no, I know that I want this new TC to be right. And that doesn't mean just building another Grendon. Life had moved on. Research had moved on, practice had moved on, and the TC at Marchington needed to sort of reflect that. So I said yes. So they hired me, made me an assistant director in their terms and director of therapy, and I jumped ship. And that was when life started, really. Because I rocked up at Premier Prisons headquarters and I spent a day chatting to the finance director and one or two other people and things, whatever. They didn't really have much for me to do. And then I got a phone call that said, we need you to present what a therapeutic community is to our merchant bankers on Tuesday morning. Now, this was the Thursday of the week before, whatever. I said, yeah, I can do that. That's not a problem. So I put together this beautiful kind of presentation, whatever else. And I wandered up and I had to go to Lazard's bank. And it was kind of like the door was open to me. And their doorman, I could see, was wearing a suit that I could never afford, you know. And the place was just marble from floor to ceiling. And they took me up to their ballroom and sort of swung half a wall round to reveal all their stuff and said, and the CEO of Premier Prisons was there. He was a sort of ex-SAS Australian, you know, guy, and a guy from the American company that was there. And they sat me down and said, right, take me through it. So I went through, and at some point I just said something along the lines of, in any prison, there is the likelihood that somebody will die, not through it. And this guy leaned across, he says, hang on a moment. He said, we'd prefer you not to say that. And I said, well, it is, you know, he said, you're asking this group of people who are going to come in here for 8 million in order to build this. And I went, oh, right, okay. So within my first 10 days of being in there, I was suddenly pitching to these guys for millions to actually get the bloody place built. And I kind of clicked in then that, you know, what I've stepped into here is a totally different ball game. You know, this isn't fluffy civil servants who arm and are and be nice to you and then sort of, you know, go away and do something different or whatever else. These are upfront money people who need, you know, this to be delivered. So get it right. So, yeah, so it focused me very, very clearly after that. And then, yeah, they gave us the 8, well, they didn't give us, they lent it to us at a percentage. But then it was a case of I had to deliver. And I literally went and lived in a hard hat and a pair of steel tap boots. There was me and the new director to start off with in a porter cabin on a building site, watching these guys actually build the place and going to the building meetings and people saying to me, do you still want that there? Because if you do, then we'll build it. But if you don't, we can change it around and sort of do it for you. So we were sitting there on my feet. And so that's how it started. There was just the two of us. And then gradually I brought people on board, like Claire Moore and Maria Hemmings, to begin to build the structure. And then from then on, it was it's very, very difficult to explain what that act of creation actually is like. It's all consuming because it's you build everything from the walls to the furniture to the color schemes to the bedding to the training to the first tranche of people who come in to then bringing in all your staff and then bringing in 200 people to start up four different therapeutic communities and an assessment unit. And it was kind of the process was just mind-blowing, really. But it was a case of having all the time to question what was being done and what the model was, and being able to stick to the vision of what a day like what a day was going to be like in that therapeutic community and what was being offered, and holding on to the principles of doing things as a team and developing things as a team.
And can I say, Roland, because I've been reading your chapter in Eric Cullen and Judy McKenzie's book, which is an excellent description of that period, and I recommend it to anybody to go and seek that out. But I wonder if we could focus a bit upon the model, because as you say, you have to sit down and work out the model. And I'm going to put it to you that in retrospect, and I wouldn't have thought this then, but in retrospect, I think the way the model is described is as much to do with power and power structures, particularly that between psychologists and psychiatrists, as it is to do with anything else.
I think it was about understandings. And I think this goes back to about the way people conceive of their world. I mean, in some senses, we are molded by our by the people we learn most from, really. And one of the things that struck me, one of the reasons why we chose Yalom as the foundation, was that when I was at Gartry and I set the TC up at Gartry, was what I found was, A, that the prison staff could be brilliant TC workers because I'd had years of working with PD people and violent people and whatever else, and surviving that and working with them and whatever else. And when you brought them into a situation where they could explore the relationships, they had so much already in place. They were just brilliant. But they were just like, they were working class guys like I was, you know. And my world didn't work in a Lacan type of way or a Beyond type of way. You know, and my experience of being trained where I sat there and some po-faced bloody analyst refused to talk or enter into it and just sort of said, oh, now the group's begun because somebody's shown some emotion. Not that they would say because somebody's shown their emotion. They just say, oh, now the group's begun. And I felt that was so outlandish and so arrogant and insulting to the people there that I really didn't want anybody who was going to come and do all the things that I wanted them to do and ask them to do to be insulted like that. I wanted them, it was my responsibility to find a language that made sense to them in their real world, dealing with real world people. You know, they were dealing with guys who would come along. I mean, I was saying things like, if a guy just doesn't feel right and he needs to change, that's good enough motivation for me. Now, you needed a whole kind of language that fitted that. And for people to be able to accept people on that basis and then get into the work and things and whatever else. If you start talking about pairing in groups and underlying unconscious stuff and whatever else, you lose them at stage one. And so we devised all our training to be kind of like in the here and now and things. It didn't mean that these guys wouldn't understand it later on, but people need to experience the processes in a way that they can make sense of, that they can incorporate into their internal universes before you start giving them stuff like Lacan and the philosophical stuff and all the rest of it in there, because they have to live it. And my staff and the residents who came in had to live being in a TC right from the start. So it wasn't about... I don't think it wasn't about power. It was about making the experience livable and understandable. And Yalom, for me, had done that. And in my experience at Gartry had shown me that as well. So, I mean, it was, I don't think it was a thing about psychiatry and psychology. I was just looking for a sense of what really made things workable in an everyday thing. And the other thing that I did was I took all the clinicians out of civvies. I insisted that all the clinicians trained as prison custody officers, because my clinicians were going to be their managers. And I didn't want clinical managers not being able to do what prison custody officers could do, because I didn't want them standing back and saying, well, you're the prison custody officer, you drag him out of the cell. I wanted clinicians who could bite the bullet and go, push comes to shove, I can be part of a three-man team and get that guy out of a cell as well. Because I didn't want my clinicians to be talking about their staff team as about, well, the staff team are a real problem, while they're sitting there in their civvies and doing 9 to 5. You know, I wanted everybody in that team, in that therapeutic community, to actually be equal. And if they were wearing the same uniform, and if they were all PCO trained, and if they'd all done the TC training, there was a real chance then that they could actually model being a TC and a way of being with the residents and how that actually worked. Now, you know, we got in there and we did that. And I don't think it's for me to sort of say how that is, but I think there was a bit of me at the back of my head that knew that if anything was going to get eroded, that might be one of the elements of it, because prisons have a nasty habit of reverting back to type and back to the macro bit and back to, I've been, getting into a suit is seen as a way of escaping something, or, you know, and that just sort of says to me, well, that tells me a lot about how you value the people on the ground floor doing the work, whereas I wanted everybody to sort of be equal. So it was more about, I mean, maybe that's my arrogance about thinking I knew better at the time, but I wanted there to be a real kind of sense of democracy and equality in there that wasn't just lip service, that was actually, you know, workable and visible and there, really. So I think it was all that kind of stuff that I was striving for, really. And it, yeah.
And very, very different to, I suppose, how things are ordinarily run in prisons. You know, that's really a very unorthodox way of working, and must have been a real challenge to the system, really, to have that happen. I think you know, in David's recollection of, I think you spoke earlier about the therapeutic community's research engine for meaning. And so there's a kind of like a quirky way of thinking about things that challenges what we know, and looking at things from a very different perspective. And that's been a persistent theme amongst the people that we've interviewed for the podcast, actually, that people who challenge conventional wisdom by taking a different stance on things. And I wondered whether you have to be a bit quirky and a bit unorthodox whether you have to be comfortable with being different.
I think you have to be vaguely psychopathic. You can't afford to, it's about, I think you have to be very clear about what it is you're doing and know why you're doing it. I mean, I always said, you know, if in a therapeutic community, if you couldn't explain why you were doing it and what was therapeutic about it, you shouldn't be doing it. And of course, when you open up an entire huge one, then that becomes quite, but if you've done the thinking and if you've done the talking and whatever else, then, you know, I felt that I should be able to sort of account for myself in that and what we're doing. And so it's kind of, but you have to be able to hold that vision. And in doing that, I think there are times when you have to be very clear about, I'm not going down that path just because that's where you are. You know, that isn't where I want to go. And that's not where I want this TC to go. And the obvious one for me was the difference in management style between me and what was expected in the prison service. I had the Senate, and in the Senate were my managers, my TC managers. And I was very clear right from the beginning that you are responsible for that therapeutic community. You and your staff team are responsible for that. I am not going to visit you. I'm not going to come in and sit on your community meetings. I'm not going to come around and pat you on the head and say you're doing really well. My place is in the fluffy, in the Senate meeting with you, and we work out how we take the whole place forward or whatever else. And if one of you has got a problem in your community, then we all have. And that's where we sort it around things. But I ain't coming down there to sort it out for you. So go away and do it. And I got heavily criticized. I got all this stuff about, well, you don't do managing by walking about. And it's kind of like, no, I don't. You're too bloody right. I do managing by sitting with the people who are supposed to manage and working through what they need to do. But it was... It's about sort of being clear about that and knowing why you're doing it. I think that's the bit I think that's important. But yeah,
managing by walking about was my favourite book for a long time. My ideal way of managing.
But I think it's just, you know, no one management or leadership style is right across the board. And, you know, I think I probably would have wanted my therapy managers on their units to walk about their communities, but it wasn't for me to invade that and walk about for what I needed to do in my role. My role there was, my job was to maintain the boundaries around a therapeutic community so that the relationship between the therapeutic community and the rest of the prison, so there was no kind of invasion. My job was to make that therapeutic space safe for everybody else to get on and do what they did. And my bit with the rest of the thing was my stuff, really. So meat and a sandwich stuff, really. But hey, that's how it is, really.
So, well, where to take this now? You're clearly a charismatic leader.
Right? No, I'm not. I mean, I will argue day in, day out I'm not. My whole precept of setting up both Gartry and Grendon was, and I said all the way along, was that the test of whether they would survive and continue to be therapeutic was in their structures and their processes. And the fact that I very early on in the designing and the setting up got the community of communities involved in the accreditation process, because they needed that in order to make sure that there was a long-term standard in there, and that it wasn't me, it wasn't me saying this is how I want it, but it was kind of like, I have a view of how I want it, but there are benchmarks and I want you to be accredited, and I want you to be accredited as quickly as possible, so that, you know, yeah, so it's yeah, I
it sounds like there's quite a lot of space for you to be a bit maverick, and I was wondering how, if you were younger and were just joining the prison service now, I was wondering how you might get on.
I wouldn't. You know, it's just depressing, really, the way the prison service. Actually, that's unfair. There is really good work going on. I mean, because I still do the enabling environments, it's still a delight to meet people in the criminal justice system who are bright and creative and kind and compassionate, who are doing really good work and whatever else. And there are bright spots like the TCs and the pipes and the EEs and things and whatever else. And it's kind of, yeah, the working side. There is something wrong with the overall organisation at a conceptual level and at a structural. And when you get up into the structural and political level, it that's where it all goes awry, really. And part of it is trying to manage a sort of huge Leviathan organization. There are inbuilt inherent difficulties in that, but there are also kind of status quo things that suck the living daylights out of it, really, and kill creativity and things. So it's yeah, everybody has KPIs and boxes to tick and whatever else, and you know, it's there is a level in public service where the key factor is not embarrassing the minister. If a minister starts to begin to shuffle their feet and go, this is very embarrassing, you get a horde of apparatchiks appear and go, you need to do that, you need to do this, and yeah, because you can't embarrass the minister. And it sounds bizarre, but yeah, that's one of the things that happens. So yeah, it's not that the people in prison lack humanity, it's that the organization manages to squeeze too much of it out of them, really, and doesn't trust them enough. I think that's one of my things, and I don't see I don't see the flexibility and the tolerance for mavericks around like there used to be. I turned up in Gartry when it was still in the dispersal prison in a peach suit and a pair of sunshine boots. And it was kind of like, you know, it wasn't the done thing then, but it was, you know, I got away with it, and I could, you know, sort of blag my way through that, really. Wouldn't happen now, I don't think. You know, somebody be saying this is terribly unprofessional and stuff.
Although it's hard to know how we, you know, to what degree we do that to ourselves. It always amazes me how staff that are free to wear whatever they want within reason, the clinical staff, gravitate towards wearing black trousers and white shirts.
Yeah.
And it's like, why would you do that? You can wear lots of other colours, but you've chosen. And obviously it's about trying to fit in and belong. And, you know, when you're in a system where there's quite a lot of fear and sense of threat, people obviously try to make themselves feel safe, don't they? And you do that by being part of the group. But yeah, absolutely share that sense of sometimes finding yourself thinking, I'm wearing something that somebody's going to consider is just really the wrong thing, even though it would be perfectly reasonable attire in a different set of circumstances. Yeah.
Did you have a last question?
I do. Yeah. So obviously, Roland, you know, you've been in contact with the criminal justice system for 40 years, I think you said. And one of the things that both David and I were thinking about before we started this podcast was about how some people end up really quite cynical and jaded after their after having been in contact with the system for so long. And we were wondering, we ask each guest that comes on, how do you keep yourself kind of like nourished and guard against that kind of that sense of cynicism?
Two things, really. Because I'm still involved with enabling environments, and I see services change in a way which does put people's relationships at the centre. And when they do that, I see happier, more productive, more content, more fulfilled, more inquisitive people. And they're in environments which encourage that at work. So it's kind of like it's possible. And I go on seeing it being possible. And
well, such a fascinating interview, Roland. It feels like we've been all over the place and touched on some really important stuff.
Yeah, I really enjoy the conversation, Roland.
Good. Well, yeah, I have to
finish my sentence. Stop it.
Sorry.
What I was going to say when I was suggesting that you're a charismatic leader was that you inspire great loyalty. So, all around the place are these people who have picked up and learned from you and gone on to do other things. You don't have to answer that.
I was going to say I'm mildly surprised by that. But it is wherever I've been, I have to say that the people that I managed, my managers, have remained friends. I mean, and I'd like to think that's something about I trusted them at the time to sort of be who I thought they were and deliver and whatever, and tried to make that message explicit, really. And I just hope that still being friends with them is a consequence of that, really. So, yeah.
Great. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I feel like I've gabbled at you for however long, which I am frequently accused of.
Oh, I really enjoyed that conversation with Roland, David. It was, I think, really interesting to hear about somebody coming from such a working class background and finding a way to work within the system. And I particularly found it interesting when you think about psychoanalytic, psychodynamic psychotherapy does have a reputation for being somewhat elitist. And I thought it was quite interesting his reflections on how the model of treatment needed to change to be more accessible to people who were not coming from a really educated, affluent background in order to find it accessible. So I could really get what he was saying about that need to, I suppose he was talking about keeping it real, really, wasn't he? That talking to people in language that they understood and not leaving big lengthy silences, which would leave people feeling too anxious.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was a really interesting conversation. Ronan's clearly a very able creator of therapeutic settings and teams, and all the members of his past teams continue to love him. I really liked his notion of the TC as a search engine for meaning. That places the emphasis on the process, the group process, in enabling the individual to discover meaning for themselves. He's actually left an enormous legacy, particularly at HMP Gartree and at Dovegate. Though there's still a sense in those projects that they have to be constantly aware of the pressure from outside to change, to be more like the rest of the prison. When, of course, the whole point is that they are different. And really, they would like to change the rest of the prison. And that's sometimes where the tension arises. There were two other things that stood out for me. He was clearly unhappy with the idea that he's a charismatic leader. And he tried very hard to establish structures to clarify management and invest authority in his colleagues. But there were painful struggles after he left Dovegate, and the question of how to manage this kind of transition remains unresolved, and perhaps it always will.
Well, I was just, I was, one of the things I was really struck by when he spoke was how, you know, how often you encounter people who want status but don't want the responsibility. And I felt he was kind of like the inverse of that. There was a sense of, if you're going to have the status, then you need to make sure that you're taking the responsibility. So the idea of making sure that psychologists understood what it meant to be involved in CNR, for instance, sorry, control and restraint, for instance, rather than just sitting on the sidelines pontificating about what happens.
Yeah, I think that's right. And they did that for a number of years, and they all wore the same uniforms. This is at Dovegate. But it has drifted back towards the mean, as you might say. So they now do have a clear differentiation between what you might think of as officer staff and clinical staff. So he was right in predicting that that kind of thing would occur. But the other thing that struck me was his response to my question about power, and particularly when he was at Grendon and how that related to the therapeutic model. You see, I thought he was presenting a sort of caricature of a therapy group, although I do know that, you know, some groups can be fairly difficult to endure. But nevertheless, it's clear that when working inside prisons, you need a different, a much more in touch model of group therapy. And I think it was really something to do with the conflict between psychiatrists and psychologists, with the former insisting on having the last word. And so the issue was, who's really in charge of the model? And if we moved on from that, I think that the administration of power will crop up again, as it's such a key feature of healthy team functioning. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.